All right, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. So this is our weekly Kabbalah class. Very special day today for multiple reasons. So number one, we find ourselves in the midst of the holiday of Sukkot, which is always a wonderful holiday. It's a holiday that's associated with unity, with togetherness. It's associated with a lot of joy and with huts. We're usually in the sukkah for this class. We're usually in the sukkah, but we're usually in the other location. So things, as you all know, are kind of, we're in between locales. So we're here, so we're inside. But right after the class, everyone will have the opportunity to go out to the sukkah. We can do a blessing on some food, on some snacks, and the lulav and the esrog, which I have elsewhere in the building. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, Sisi, who has been with us for 8 years plus. Sisi is preparing to move back to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna miss you a lot.
Well, I'll be here for at least a few more weeks.
A few more weeks, okay. So it's not the farewell yet. We don't say farewell, we just say till next time. Till next time, but it's, I'm thinking of you as we enter into October. And because I know that's when you're moving, so we won't say our goodbyes yet. But it's. I'm glad that you're here, and we're here together for Kabbalah and Coffee. Okay, so last time we met, which was a week ago, the topic that we focused on was the idea of lost souls, and we asked the question: what does Kabbalah say about lost souls? Is there ever a concept of a soul being lost? Can a soul be lost, or is that not even a possibility? We discuss this from multiple perspectives. We presented what might appear in Jewish law to be a vote, if you will, that souls can be lost. There's a concept of karet, which is typically translated as soul excision, I want to say. What's the excision? Is that a word? Where it's like cut off?
Yeah.
Where the soul is cut off? But we explained that although when you look at things on a surface level, it might seem, I'll get this out of your way, it may seem like there's a concept in Judaism such as soul excision. When you look at it a little bit deeper through the lens of the mystics, you soon realize that a soul can't be wholly and completely cut off. It's not possible. Only perhaps the more external dimension of the soul, they can be compromised, but not the core of the soul. Why? Because the core of the soul is always and forever connected. So this is a major point that we need to focus on as we advance into our text. I believe today we're starting, I think we did chapter 6 last time. We're picking it up with chapter 7. Does that make sense? Who remembers from last time? Yeah, we're starting from chapter 7 on 365. But not yet. So here's the important idea. And without getting into all the Kabbalistic details of it, and it can get very detailed, there are various dimensions of the soul. But here's what we need to know, that we have access only to certain dimensions of the soul, whereas other dimensions of the soul remain so completely pristine that we don't even have access to it. The best example I can give is when it comes to technology. There are certain things that you can modify on your computer, on your phone, whatever it is, certain things that you can modify and change. And then each manufacturer has its things where it basically blocks you out. It puts up some sort of technological wall and it says you can't access this unless you're actually a programmer and you know how to do it. So for example, when it comes to iPhones, I don't know if this is still possible. Back in the day, a few years ago, it used to be possible to jailbreak your phone. Is anybody familiar with that phrase, jailbreaking your phone? Jailbreaking your phone would give you access to system files where you can modify things in your phone and create different, I don't know, whatever it is. I'm more of an Android guy, whatever it is, but you could somehow modify your phone on a deeper level than you could ordinarily without jailbreaking. So without jailbreaking, in other words, if you buy the phone out of the box, you can only access certain features, certain realities, certain dimensions, certain parts of the phone. Other parts you can't touch. Why? It's by design, so you don't break your phone. They don't want you to access the inner workings of it because they don't want you to compromise your phone. They don't want you to brick your phone and it just becomes worthless. The same thing is true with Android. for example, a platform that I know better because I have an Android and I've had one for several years now. It's possible to it's called root, to root your phone, which means you're reaching root access, the core of whatever it is inside, and then you can modify things and open up new possibilities for your phone that wouldn't exist otherwise. But again, under normal circumstances, if you're not an expert hacker or not hacker, whatever, if you're not an expert in these things or you don't follow the various tutorials that show up on YouTube or whatever in forums, you can't access these files. So in a similar vein, obviously it's not exactly the same, but in a similar context, we have the idea that you and I typically have access to lower dimensions of the soul, more external dimensions of the soul. The true core of the soul remains behind that firewall or behind that, you know, that door, behind the curtain that you and I can't access under normal circumstances. And it's, what does that mean? What it means is that these are the truths, the core truths of the soul that remain so pure and so essential that under normal circumstances, you and I are not living by these dimensions. So when we wake up in the morning and we begin to regain our consciousness after some hours of sleep, we become aware of ourselves and we become aware of our surroundings. So we become aware of ourself and become aware of the things around us and the people around us on a level on the lower dimensions of the soul. We're typically not aware of the core truth of who we are immediately. We're typically not living on that level. And so we can do things that are not consistent with the core of our being. So Kabbalah teaches that the core of our being is absolutely one and unified and connected with Hashem, with God. And not in a way of separate entities, but in a way that is part and parcel of the divine, if you will. To give an example, you have two forms of writing letters. I don't mean like dear so-and-so, but there's two forms of writing. One is ink on paper. So you have in front of you, hopefully you have a copy of the text, and here you see the black text on the white paper. Now you and I know that there are really two entities, even though it looks like it's very much, you know, the ink, the lettering is part of the paper, but you and I know that they began as separate, in separate spaces. The paper began as a blank sheet of paper, and the printer has its toner, however that works, however magic that works, right? And the printer somehow puts that toner down on the paper. And if you're writing something, pen to paper, it's the same thing. You start off with a blank sheet of paper. You take a pen that has ink, and you're now putting the ink, laying the ink down on the paper. So even as the ink and the paper are unified, it's a unification of two entities that began separate. They began in separate spaces. So the paper began in one space, the ink began in a separate space, and at a certain point in time, they become joined together as one. The truth is that even as they're one, they remain two. And even though to the eye it might look like it's collapsed, it's all one thing, if you had a knife, if you had one of those, it's kind of like it has, well, not exactly an X-Acto. It kind of looks like a pen. And then it comes to like a triangle, little blade over there.
Yeah.
I don't know what you can, maybe it's exact. Maybe it's.
I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. Like a scalpel, but not like a medical grade thing. Yes. So I know this because my grandfather, my Zaidi, is a scribe. And one of the things when it comes to scribes is in a Torah scroll, if there's a letter that needs to be corrected, so there's over 360, there's about 300,000 letters in the Torah. So if even one letter is not written correctly, or over time, if it fades or breaks or whatever it is, even one letter, the whole Torah is not kosher, and you can't read from the Torah, so you have to fix it. So sometimes if a letter needs to be rewritten, so you have to take one of these blades, and you scratch off the letter very carefully, because you don't want to damage the parchment underneath it. No, no, white, no. Right, exactly, no. None of that correction tape or whatever it is, no. So you have to scrape off the letter, and you should know the ink of a Torah scroll is handmade and specially formulated that it doesn't bleed into the parchment. That it remains, it dries quickly, because it has to dry very quickly, because the sofer, the scribe, is writing it by hand. If it takes time to that would take forever. It takes almost a year to write a Torah by hand anyway. So you can imagine if it dried even slowly. So it has to dry really quickly, but also the letters remain raised. We've all felt like invitations or whatever with raised lettering. So if it's a raised letter, it's easier to take off. Again, these letters don't feel raised, so to separate them would be a little bit more of an effort, although I think you probably still could do it, unless it's truly all the way through and through bled. I don't think it is. It's still possible if you can really get down to it in a very fine way. But a Torah scroll is a great example where the letters dry, and if you touch it, we're not supposed to touch the scroll itself, but if you touch it, you would feel that the letters are really
embossed.
Yeah, it's kind of whatever. It's laying on top, so you can scrape it off fairly easily. So it's strong enough that it shouldn't wear out under normal circumstances. Although eventually it does after who knows decades of use, but it should remain. But you can still scrape it off, and it dries quickly. It has all these interesting properties. It's a very unique type of ink. The point is though, that when it comes to ink on paper or parchment or pen on paper or whatever it is, you have two separate entities. And no matter how unified they might appear to be, at the end of the day, they're still two. Whereas when it comes to letters that are engraved in stone, for example, so you have letters that are engraved in a stone, the letter and the stone are not two separate entities. The letter is part of the stone. The letter that you see is none other than the hollow in the stone. But the point is that the stone itself is helping formulate the letter. It's not two separate entities, it's one. Which leads into a story. There was once a young man in the 1940s who was sent by the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the previous Chabad Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, to go around to communities, probably in the northeast of the United States, to speak about Judaism and to encourage Judaism in those communities. And so this young man comes back from his few week tour. Not a 3-hour tour, that's a different island. And this young man comes back to the previous Rebbe, and he reports back what he did, who he met, which communities he went to, and what he said. And he gave the and he told the Rebbe then, the then Rebbe, he said that what I said to the community that I spoke at the synagogue, what I said is that each one of us is like a letter in a Torah scroll. And just like I mentioned before, just like a Torah scroll is only kosher when all the letters are intact with their full integrity, so too, we as a people, each one of us is only whole if we're all together. If we're all representing. If any one of us is missing, is lacking, or whatever it is, then it affects not only the individual, but all of us. So we all need to be part of a collective. We all need to feel like we're part of something greater than ourselves, etc., part of a larger community, and that was his spiel. And then he continued. And he said, and even if a letter is missing or faded, it can always be rewritten. And that was his speech. Sounds lovely. The Rebbe said, you got it wrong. The letters are not written letters, they're engraved letters. Because no one's letter can ever be missing or faded. Because no one's soul can ever be missing or faded. The letter is always there. The better example is the other example of writing, which I already told you, is engraved letters. The engraved letters, the engraving, it might be that over time, the letters get filled in with dirt or dust. The stone gets covered and you can't read the letters. But it doesn't mean the letters aren't there. All it means is that you need to take away, in Yiddish we call it the schmutz. You know what the schmutz is? The dirt. It's the, right, dirt. You take away the schmutz, and the letters are always there. So the previous Rebbe told this young man, he said, I don't know if he said it, go back and tell them, correct your message. But the point is that we're all a letter. We all have a soul. But the letters are not written letters, they're engraved letters. And the difference is big. It's a difference of whether our connection to God, bless you, is a matter of proximity or a matter of essence. It's not just proximity. When it comes to ink on paper, it's a matter of proximity. There's no essential bond between the ink and the paper. On this paper, it could have been written anything, right? It didn't have to be written this way. It didn't have to have these words. Two separate entities that just happen to find themselves in close proximity to each other. It's like the friends that you meet, you know, in school, or the neighbor, you know, that your friends growing up. The question is, I'm not questioning anyone's friendships, but a question could be asked. Are they real friends, and maybe they can become real friends, or were they friends of proximity? You happen to grow up next door to that person, so you were friends. I remember hearing from somebody who said that they initially had this friend because they were in the same area, in the same neighborhood, and then they realized after a few years, they don't like this person. They were hanging out all the time, but you know what? I don't actually get... Again, don't try this at home. We should love everybody and we should get along. But this was a very interesting perspective. Somebody saying, you know what? It turns out I was hanging out with this person a lot, or with this family, whatever it is, a lot. But it was just proximity. It wasn't a real connection. And so written letters, ink, parchment, paper, whatever it is, two separate entities, those are connections of proximity, because the two forms, the two things, the two entities are in proximity, therefore they look like they're bonded. And they might be bonded on some level. But then there's another connection that is essential. Because anything that is superimposed, if it's put together, it can be taken apart. In other words, if the only connection that exists is because at some point in time these two entities were smushed together, then at some point, another point in time, theoretically, they can be pulled apart. But when you're dealing with something essential, and the example of the engraved letters is also not a perfect example, because at a certain point in time, those letters weren't there. And it could have been the stone could have remained without letters, or it could have had other letters. So it's still not a perfect example. But if you can think of an essential bond between a parent and a child, for example, a bond that is not, although again also it begins at a certain time, it's hard to find a human example that is perfectly essential. But nonetheless, if we can conceive of such an example where the connection is not a manufactured connection, it's not a connection of convenience or proximity or manufacturing where we've put two parties together, but rather they are one because they are one. There's no other reason that they're one other than because they're one. They're one because they're one. If we can find that example, and if we can understand that example, then we will touch on the true identity of the soul. A soul, as explained in Kabbalah, is a chelek eloka mima'al mamash, which means literally a piece of God above. And the question is, what, we're cutting God into pieces? You got a piece and I got a piece, right? So we took God, right? I just made a lot of potato kugel a few days ago. So I used one of those food processors. So for the onions, I'm giving you insight into my potato kugel recipes. So when it comes to the onions, I put the blade to whatever it's called, puree, right? Whatever, to like mush it. That's the official term, mush it. When it comes to the potatoes, I grate it. So is that what we're doing to God? We're like putting like God through the grater so that cuts God into, God forbid, right, into multiple pieces and everyone gets a little piece of God? Of course not. In fact, the Talmud, which is not necessarily a work of Kabbalah, but the Talmud deals with this question. The Talmud says, there was once a Roman noble person, either a noble man, noble woman, whatever, a Roman nobility who asked, I think it was Rabbi Akiva. He said, what do you mean that God is found within every person? Are there multiple gods? Rabbi Akiva said, I think it was Rabbi Akiva who said, when the sun shines and you have light in your house and I have light in my house, are there multiple suns? A Jew always answers a question with a question, right? What, you mean to tell me there are multiple suns? Because I have a sunlight in my house and you have sunlight in your house, so it must mean there's multiple suns. His point was, you could have one God whose light, if you will, and more than light, essence, radiates within many, many, many people, billions of people. And that's the identity of the soul. The soul is not a separate entity that was brought in proximity to God. The soul is part and parcel of God. Now, we're not going to say that the soul is God, because the soul is still a piece of God. It's not the totality of God, right? But the soul's connection to God is not one of superimposition or manufactured or proximity or two entities becoming put together, but it's rather one of essence. And therefore, just like one entity . So the paper and the ink, they can divest themselves of each other. In other words, they can disintegrate. The paper can say to the ink, theoretically, right? No, thank you. You're trying to impose your ideas on me? I don't like these ideas. And you can erase the writing. But the paper can't get rid of itself. Right? The paper is paper. And the ink is ink. A soul is a piece of God. Can't get rid of that. So when we talk about lost souls, can a soul really be lost? On the lower levels of the soul, on the lower levels of the soul are those pieces where we have more access to. We can make it nice and shiny. We can make it dull. We can make it more beautiful. We can compromise it in a negative sense through our actions. There's a lot of stuff that we can do to the lower parts of the soul. And on those levels of the soul, we say that that soul is connected by virtue of proximity. If the soul is doing what it needs to do, then it's connected. And if it's not, it's disconnected. In other words, that the lower parts of the soul, we say, are like the ink on the parchment. But the essence of the soul, the true reality, true identity of the soul, that is part and parcel of God, piece of God, literally a piece of God that cannot be created or destroyed by our efforts.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that there is an engraving. Even engravings is not the perfect example.
Right.
But the perfect situation is when God created the tablets and the Torah all at once when he handed it.
Right, and it's what's interesting is that when it comes to the tablets and the Torah scroll, here you have an example of both forms of writing. The tablets were engraved, and the Torah scroll was written. And in the Ark of the Covenant, which we spoke about, we had a series on the secrets of the Lost Ark. In the Ark of the Covenant, there were the tablets, the engraved tablets, as well as a Torah scroll. Either inside it or right next to it, there's a dispute in the Talmud about where the Torah scroll was placed in the Holy of Holies. But the bottom line is it had both. The message is that our connection to God, and this is really where we're headed, it ought not remain only on an essential level in the sense that, well, it's who we are. No matter what we do, we can't get rid of who we are. Not that we would want to, but we can't compromise who we are. That's our core identity. We don't have access to touch it, to mess it up. So therefore, there's a pristine core. Really, our mission in life is to take that core connection and manifest it in our written lives, so to speak, in our everyday lives, in the lives that we live on a day-to-day basis, where we're making choices to do the right thing or to, God forbid, do the opposite. It's to make the correct choice to live a little bit more in alignment with who we are in our essence. Now, we know that if we're out of alignment, let's say the back, God forbid, is out of alignment, it feels uncomfortable, right? If the spine, right, if there's not... We should all be healthy. But if someone's spine, you know, starts off, you know, in one place and then at some point is going elsewhere, so it's not an ideal scenario, right? And it's going to cause pain. The same thing is true in our lives. If our core, and it's not if, our core is aligned with the truth, our core is aligned with Hashem. If our conscious, but that's a core that we might not be aware of even, if our conscious lives are in a different place, then spiritually, we're a little bit out of alignment. And that's going to cause some measure of pain. Emotional pain, existential pain, some sort of angst, discomfort, dissatisfaction, just an inner turmoil, because we feel that we're not, something feels off, something feels wrong. And in truth, what's happening is that our core is in one place and our day-to-day actions are somewhere else. And the truth is there are multiple dimensions. There's the core, there's our ideas, our feelings, and our actions. So really four dimensions: the spirit, the mind, the heart, and the actions. And the question is, on these four levels, are we totally aligned or not? Our core obviously is with God, but where's our head at? And even if our head is in the right place, but how do we feel? And even if we feel, even if our feelings are in the right place, when it comes to actions, what are we doing? And it could be, yeah, these correspond to the four worlds: emanation, creation, formation, and action. Exactly. It's the construct of four. So these four realities, the spirit, the mind, the heart, and the action, the question is, are they aligned or are they, you know, like I believe in this, but when I go to work, I do that. I don't really believe in it, but that's what I have to do for my work. So, you know, I have ideas here, but I'm doing this, and I feel that way, and it's all over the place. So that's not going to feel good, you know, in the long term. We can get away with it for a little bit. You know, we can get away with, you know, not feeling great for a little bit, but after a while, it takes its toll, and it's time for, I guess, the Kabbalistic chiropractic adjustment, where we get back aligned with who we really are. But the point here is that our core never gets misaligned. It can't get misaligned because it's part of God. God can't get misaligned, so we can't get misaligned because the core can't. But the kunst, the trick is not only that the core should be pure, but that we should be aligned with that.
So I guess that kind of answered one of my questions. My other question is, like, if people, or even one person creates something artistic, whatever, an artwork, yeah. Does that have a soul, and is that a piece of God, or are we just talking about people?
So we're mainly talking about people right now, although the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, who's the great Kabbalist of the 1500s, he wrote and he taught that every single thing has a soul. Even, he says, even an even domain, even a still and silent rock, right? Just stone that just doesn't do anything. It just sits there, right? Even that stone, not moving, not growing, not walking, not talking, not feeling, seems like it's doing nothing, just sitting there. Even that stone has a soul. And it's constantly being breathed into existence by the word of God. So when we speak of souls, you're asking a very good question. In general, everything has a soul. But the soul that I'm speaking of is the unique human soul. The human soul that's, everything is ultimately from God. But the question is, how transparent is it to that reality?
But wouldn't the artwork be, the soul come from the person who created the artwork?
Yes.
Like, this book doesn't have a soul, but the person who wrote this created the...
They invested their energy into it, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So in addition to the...
The rock comes from earth?
Right.
So it would have a soul.
So here's the thing. Everything needs a soul. The understanding of Kabbalah is... It almost touches a little bit on science, although there's a big gap between... When I say big gap, you'll see what I mean in a second. There's the basic physical substance of things, and then there's the structure and the form that it takes. So you have basically like the basic, I don't know, what's like even beyond atoms, like quarks or something, I don't know. There's like the basic particles of existence. But then there's what gives it structure and form, and what gives it space and dimension. And I'm not saying that is the soul, the dimension of it, but that's part of what the soul does, is it gives it its substance. Science says now that if you reduce the entire universe that we know into just its actual matter, it can fit in the palm of your hand. The entire substance of the entire universe can fit into the palm of your hand. Now it would be extremely heavy, right? You couldn't lift it. But it could fit. Most of what we see is empty space. If you were able to collapse everything, it wouldn't take up a lot of space, which is a mind-blowing thing. In fact, we once had a speaker at the old location. You know that, you know, above the fireplace we have that, it's kind of like a brick wall? It used to be the natural color of the brick. Now I think we painted over it a few years ago. Whatever. Anyway, so this rabbi and scientist said that based on physics, you should be able to put your hand through that wall because there's more empty space than resistance. Why can't you? It's complicated why you can't. I don't remember what he said, but I've also looked it up. It's complicated why you can't. You should be able to. You should be able to put your hand through a brick wall. The fact that you can't is because of some sort of interesting anomaly, or not anomaly when it comes to science, where I don't remember the exact... The point is, there's a lot of empty space. So number one, the soul of a stone, of a rock, is what gives it its form. What gives it its form, its structure. So on a basic level, the fact that this exists like this, it has to have a soul, or else it would just collapse into nothingness on one level. But then you're right. There's the soul that the artist, the author and the artist, Rabbi Harvey, a graphic novel of Jewish wisdom and wit in the Wild West. Classic.
Isn't it Jews in the Wild West?
Who knows? Somebody just gave it to me this morning. So this is unvetted. This is live. We're doing a live read.
I never saw any with John Wayne.
Rabbi.
Wait, so just to answer. So there is the soul of the person, the energy of a person that they're putting into it. Then this has its own energy. In fact, Kabbalah teaches that when we talk about human souls, similar concept. The body has its own soul. And that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the godly soul, the divine soul that we have. That's a piece of God. In addition to that, there's also a soul or a life force that the body itself has to exist. And then there's the spiritual consciousness that we have, the divine consciousness that we have, that is a higher level soul. So there are really multiple levels of soul. It's a really good question that you're asking. But what I'm speaking about now is the core of our consciousness, which is this divine consciousness. That's what I mean is that which is a piece of God, essentially, that can't be destroyed.
Well, just on the wall thing that you mentioned, was the explanation have anything to do with, I've heard the concept of consensus reality where, you know, because everyone says it's solid, therefore it's solid.
I don't think so. I think it's something to do with the, I don't know, we need to look it up. I'm sure there's a good, what's it, Neil deGrasse, what's his name?
deGrasse.
He's fantastic. So I'm sure there's a good physics video on this that we can look up after the class.
Who was the rabbi that...
This was Rabbi Yaffe. Was it Rabbi Yaffe or Rabbi Silverstein? I think it was Rabbi Yaffe, Rabbi Shlomo Yaffe. We spoke about this.
Sorry to interrupt you, but in martial arts, right, you know, you see people like chopping...
Yeah, mm-hmm. Through,
it's,
like, yeah.
It's basically changing your perception, right?
To not believe it to be too solid.
Right, and then
right.
The physical body does go through it.
Yeah.
It's not that they're super strong, it's just a change in perception.
There is something about the hand. It's an interesting thing, just the physics of it. When these particles approach those particles, there's some sort of reaction that makes it solid, but it's not really solid. Anyway, it's a very interesting concept.
Well, physics is changing.
So. Physics is also changing. Hey, good morning. Good to see you. Come on in. Okay. So all of this is by way of introduction, which brings us to our main point. And our main point is the following. Everything that we see, everything that exists, everything that's been created, everything that's been emanated, everything that's been animated, everything that has life and vitality in it, according to Kabbalah, exists for us. Not in an arrogant way, but in a purposeful way. So let me say that again. Everything that exists, and everything that's been emanated from God, all of the light and all of the angels and all of the dimensions and all of the worlds and the spherot, all everything that's happened, that's come out of God, so to speak, Kabbalah teaches and Judaism teaches, it's all for us. There's a reason why the human being is created last. In the story of creation, which we read about in the beginning of the book of Genesis, so it talks about light and darkness and heaven and earth, the creation of the oceans and the skies and the land and vegetation and the fish and the birds and the animals. At the very end, we have the human being. The Talmud asks the question, why is it that the human being is created last? And the Talmud gives two answers. Number one, if a person ever is too arrogant and thinks too highly of themselves, you can tell them, or you can tell yourself, even a gnat was created before me. We could say, even that was created before you, but we should rather, instead of pointing at other people, we could point at ourselves. If we ever catch ourselves getting too haughty, too arrogant, too egotistical, we can tell ourselves, we can remind ourselves, afilo yitush kadmach, even a gnat or mosquito, depending on how you translate it, maybe mosquito, even a mosquito. Gnats are smaller, right? Are gnats smaller? Mm-hmm. Do we know? Yeah.
Yeah, but mosquito would be more in the south.
That's right. I know it. I've been sitting out in a hut for the last 6-7 days. Man alive. Anyway, bugs in the hut. That's.
Can you do off in there?
Well, we had a company come before it, but it's not 100%. You know.
Put a citronellicate.
We've got multiples. Still not. I have the citronella candles with the three wicks, two of them, plus the citronella stuff that's like almost like a perfume that you put on.
What about skin so soft? That's what they use.
This I don't know.
This is what they use.
This could be the Holy Grail for...
Avon
skin
so soft.
But here's the point. Afilo yitosh kamach, even the mosquito or the gnat preceded you. That's one answer. It's like it's a reality check. That's why the human being is created last, so that we never get too carried away with ourselves. The other answer is, why is the human being created last? Because the human being is the featured attraction. So you bring in the main character once the stage is set. Right? You would never bring on, although you probably would, because you could, just because it would be different. But typically you would set up the stage and the backdrop and the music and the surrounding cast. You would have everything set before your main character walks out on the stage.
That's
why the bride at a wedding, right? The bride at a Jewish wedding walks up the last in the procession.
1 week from today.
Oh, Mazel Tov. Oh, congratulations. Very exciting. A
couple of hours.
Very exciting. And a week, though.
In a week.
So not literally a couple of hours. Right?
No, I wouldn't be sitting here.
So the second answer of the Talmud is, since the human being is so precious and so important, so central to the purpose of everything, so everything is set before, and then the human being comes out like a rock star, Adam and Eve, ready to go. You got the music blaring, right? It's, or whatever it is, and the human being comes out, ready to roll, let's get things done. That's the second answer. On one level, they're contradictory answers. Like, is it meant to minimize our ego, or is it meant to make us feel proud of who we are? And the answer is, you have to feel a little bit of both. You have to know why you're here. You have to understand, you and I, we need to know the centrality of the human being in this vision of creation. You and I can make or break the universe, quite literally. This entire, I'm not going to call it experiment. Oh, wait, I just did. This entire venture of God, everything, all the light, spiritually, the light, the spherot, the energy, the worlds, the angels, everything exists. All of this stuff, it's all for us. The question is, when we're faced with a choice, are you going to do the right thing or the wrong thing? Doesn't even matter how you feel about it. In action, bottom line, are you being a mensch or are you not being a mensch? That's what it comes down to. Are you doing what you should, or are you doing what you shouldn't do? That's the core question. That when you cut everything away and you get down to the core of life, are you acting like you should, or are you not acting like you should? And when we act like we should, we're repairing the world. Tikkun Olam fixes the world, and it justifies all of this. And when we don't, a little piece of the world, and our world certainly, is destroyed. God forbid someone else's world. So you and I have the power to build the world or destroy the world. We are central to creation. We're not just a piece of creation through the lens of Jewish teachings and Kabbalistic teachings. This is it. Not that therefore we have free rein to do whatever we want. On the contrary, we have a responsibility to take care of the earth, other forms of life, and each other. It's a responsibility. Being created last, the focal point of creation, we have a responsibility to do the right thing. So, everything is created for us. And really what we need to have, the old Hasidic saying goes that both of these Talmudic statements you should write figuratively, write down on a piece of paper or engrave it in a stone, if you will, and then put it in your pockets. In one pocket it should say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, for me the entire world was created. The other paper should say, Afilu Yitesh Kanmach, even a gnat came before me, even a mosquito came first. And when you're feeling down, when you're feeling powerless, when you're feeling like, what's the point of it all? You pull out the paper that says, the whole world was created for me. And when you're feeling a little too arrogant, then you pull out the paper that says, even a mosquito came first. But today we focus on the notion that everything is created for us. Everything outside of God's essence was created for us. In other words, even God's light, the highest form of divine light and emanation, all of that light and emanation only exists, was only manifest, only projected to create all of this, for us to be here with the choices that we have so we make the right choice and it matters. But everything goes back to us. One way of looking at this is to say that the greatest truth is found in heaven. The angels, the souls that are disembodied, the souls that are not in either before or after or whatever, but the angels and the souls and the mystical dimensions, that's where truth is. And us, we're just trying to get it right for 80, 90 years. And who knows? And who knows what we do? That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, which is the Jewish way of looking at it, the Kabbalistic way of looking at it is that none of that exists if not for us. Not the heavens, not the spiritual realities, not the souls, not the angels. Nothing exists. There's no point for it to exist if not for us. If not for us doing what we need to be doing. In other words, if we didn't exist, nothing else was needed. Theoretically, we weren't around, then what do you need the supporting cast for? You don't need any of it. It all becomes irrelevant. It's like a birthday party, a surprise birthday party that you plan for weeks. And then the day arrives, and everyone's gathered with the cake and the balloons, the whole deal. And the person never shows up. It's a little bit of a waste, right? You only needed all that stuff to celebrate with this person. But last minute, they decided to go to New York City to celebrate their birthday. So now what? Eat the cake. Why not? Enjoy it. Okay, I know they're coming back, and there's always... But you get my point, right? The whole thing, the whole what's the Yiddish word? Hullabaloo, kidding. The whole thing was all done just for this party. And if the main character doesn't show up, then what's the point? If we're not doing what we should be doing, what we need to be doing, or theoretically in a more existential level, if we didn't exist, nothing else was needed. Not the heavens, not the angels, not the souls in heaven, not the world of Atzilut, the world of emanation, not the world of Bria, the world of creation, not the world of Yetzirah, not the world of formation, and nothing else in this world. It only exists for us. And it's not a statement of arrogance. It's a statement of profound responsibility. Everything, talk about Jewish guilt, everything is riding on your shoulders. The entire history of the world. God's entire endeavor is all riding on you right now with this choice. Are you going to make the right choice? Talk about pressure.
He's got cake, right?
There's always cake. There's always cake. And that makes it better, right? There's always cake. And even some balloons. And one of those, the party blower things. Love those. Who doesn't love that? So the point is like this. Everything exists just for us. If we wouldn't be here, if there was another, if somehow we were to not be, the entire thing would shut down. That's it. It's not needed anymore. So here's the kicker. As he says in chapter 7, the entire spiritual realm and reality only exists to support us. Only to support us. When I say support us, physically, spiritually, on every level, to be there to create the framework, the life, the opportunities, the choices, but to support us also on a support level. One of the greatest expressions of this is when we get divinely inspired when we are not in a good place. So when a human being is not in a good place for themselves, they're not feeling connected, they feel uncentered. They feel like they are personally out of alignment. Maybe a person is unhappy with the choices that they've made. Maybe a person is dissatisfied with the way they're living life currently. Whatever it is. When a person is in not the best place, and only a person can truly determine that for themselves. But if a person says to themselves, I know I am not where I want to be or where I need to be. One of the greatest expressions of the truth that I just mentioned is when we get assistance from above, spiritual whisperings, divine whisperings, to help lift us out of where we're stuck and help inspire us to get to a better path, to get to a better place. And it's not the light going in to those dark alleyways because it has to. But it's going there because otherwise, why does it exist in the first place? Why does the light exist if not to sometimes go into the darkest of places? Remember, everything, even the highest divine emanations, everything exists solely to support us. What greater affirmation of that is when the light supports us in our most difficult and trying times. In our most difficult, painful, trying, disconnected, confused times. When we feel somehow a spiritual jolt of connection. This is not a distraction for the light. This is not the light going into, I have to schlep all the way over there, to that place. No. This is the light affirming why it's there in the first place. And when it inspires us, And I know I'm speaking about the light as a disembodied entity, but just work with me here. When God's light, energy, power, whatever it is, somehow reaches us and inspires us, and we get stirrings of, I gotta get myself together, I have to pick myself up, I have to get in a better place, I need to make more positive resolutions, whatever, whenever that happens, however that happens, to whoever that happens, when that happens, here's what Kabbalah teaches. This is chapter 7. When that happens, that light that inspired you, Emmy, that light ascends to its fulfillment. That light finds its purpose, realizes its entire purpose when it impacts us. Because until it impacts us, it's a supporting cast. It's a supporting cast that's not supporting it. It's theoretically supporting. When the light, when the divine inspiration reaches us and impacts us, it's, again, it's not a distraction from its purpose. It's the fulfillment of its purpose. And when it fulfills its purpose, then it attains the highest of heights. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's jump into chapter 7. 365. This is Kabbalah 365. 24/7, 365. Okay, here we go. Remember, this is written in mystical, somewhat esoteric language. But you have the concepts. You know. At this point, you know chapter 7. We're just going to go through the journey in the text. Chapter 7. I don't even know what I'm doing with the pages here. There we go. I should probably get the right page myself. 300 and... No, that's fine. I got it from the book here. 365. It is possible to say that the 13 attributes of mercy, which are a form of very lofty spiritual light, that's the light that we're talking about, the 13 attributes of mercy are endowed with a connection to a higher dimension of godliness as a result of their arousing and revealing the inner desire of the Jewish people. In other words, the 13 attributes of mercy are a very lofty dimension of spiritual consciousness. But when they descend from their lofty perch, wherever the lights typically hang out, right, wherever they're typically shining and hanging out, when they come down all the way here to schlep the individual that is not just found in the field, but in the wilderness, the spiritual wilderness, someone who's found not in a good place, God forbid, and these attributes of mercy, this divine love and divine connection reaches out, like the king in the field reaches out and stirs that awakening of connection, then those lights, the lights of the 13 attributes of mercy, I'm going to read those unbolded words again, they are then endowed with a connection to a higher dimension of godliness. They themselves ascend even higher because they have achieved their purpose. Let's continue. Since the inner desire of the Jewish people for godliness comes as a result of their existence being rooted in God's essence, let's continue, their arousal to godliness through the 13 attributes of mercy elevates these attributes and brings them into contact with his essence. In other words, when the light, when the divine light touches the soul and evokes the essence of the soul, the light itself reaches a dimension of essence that otherwise it can't reach. There's two different realities. There's essence, and then there's light. In other words, there's the core, and then there's the projection from the core, the extension outward. There's, for example, with a human being, there's you, and then there's how you project yourself to others and how others see you, which is not necessarily the same as who you are essentially. It's not exactly the same. Could be similar, but it's not synonymous. Essence in Kabbalah, essence and light are not the same. Essence is the core. Light is what comes out of that, the manifestation. Any manifestation, any step out is automatically somehow a reduction or somehow diminished from the essence itself. What we're saying now is when the light, which is an extension, which is an expression, which is a diminishment, when the light emanates from essence in order to touch the soul, which is essence, the light then takes on the light then takes on the properties of essence and is elevated to the level of essence and fulfilling its purpose. To explain the concept, the intent of the statement that creation is for the sake of the Jewish people includes not only the creation of this material world, but also the existence of all the revealed levels, even the loftiest ones within the spiritual cosmos. These elevated levels of godly revelation exist for 366, only one sole purpose: to make possible and to advance the divine service of the Jewish people. And although, I should tell you, although this, the translation and the text focuses on Yisrael, the Jewish people, more generally speaking, it refers to anybody, everyone, with a soul that is fulfilling their purpose. Again, it's a context, it's a Jewish text to a Jewish community, but in a broader sense, it's for everyone with a soul. That the light is being bestowed. The light, which is not essence, is being bestowed in order to touch the essence of the soul, and to uplift the essence of the soul, and in doing so, the light attains the dimension of essence. Let's continue. Through the descent of the 13 attributes of mercy from their natural place, which is the king's palace, metaphorically, the king's palace, a level above the spiritual cosmos, in the Hebrew, what is it? Mahamishtalshus, not the spiritual cosmos, the level above the framework of creation. So these are transcendent divine lights. But through their descent into the field to arouse and reveal the inner desire of the Jewish people, it is revealed within them that God's intent in bringing them into being was not for the revealed levels of godliness that they manifest, but for the sake of the Jewish people, whose source is in God's essence. Again, the light, everything, nothing exists outside of us. And the light, the transcendent light, also exists for us. When the light comes down into the field, the metaphorical field, to inspire us, and we get inspired in the month of Elul or the month of Tishrei with a holiday or a regular day, when that happens, the light is elevated to its source. The above concept, 367, can be connected with the verse that says a king is subjugated to the field. Now, what does that mean, a king is subjugated to the field? The king is the king and the field is the field. Even a king who has none over him is still subjugated to the field. Why? Because he derives his sustenance from it. In other words, even the king has to eat. And where does the king get his food from? The field. So even the king needs the field. On a spiritual level, it's the same thing. On this verse, the Zohar comments. Kabbalah says, who is the king? This refers to the sublime king, God, who is bonded with the field. It's possible to explain that the sustenance, as it were, of the sublime king also comes about because he descends and is drawn into the field. Listen to this shocking statement. God's light is sustained only and exists only to go down to the field and to uplift us. Because if not us, then what's the point of all of this? Through this descent, it is revealed that God's intent in the existence of the sublime rung, 368, is for the sake of the Jewish people who are rooted in God's essence. Let's continue. We're going to go straight to the end of the chapter, although it's a very long chapter, but I think we have, it's not very long, just a few more pages. But again, the core ideas should be clear. The Zohar states, let's continue, 368. There is a field and there's a field. In other words, there's two types of fields. I.e. a field of holiness and a field of the opposite of holiness. It's possible to explain that the concept that the king is subjugated to the field, that through his descent and being drawn to the field, the sublime king is elevated to a loftier level, applies not only to the field of holiness, which are mundane actions performed for the sake of heaven, but also to the field of forces opposed to holiness. Thus, it comes about primarily through the revelation of the 13 attributes of mercy that transcend the spiritual cosmos, which in a general sense are identified with the sublime king, to the Jews who are found in the desert, i.e. the field of the forces opposed to holiness. Again, the same core idea, that the king, which refers here not to God's essence, but to God's light. It's not the essence. the light. The lofty divine light, the 13 attributes of mercy, the sublime king, exist in order to go to the field that is not a holy field. Not Evander. I actually met Evander Holyfield once at a funny story.
What did y'all talk about?
We took a picture together. I probably have it on my phone. It was at a Hawks game when we were doing a Hanukkah lighting on the court at halftime. Such a complicated story. Anyway, but we hung out.
Did he know what Hanukkah was?
We told him. Yeah. Anyway, we didn't spar though. There's no way that was happening.
Oh,
anyway.
You have God on your side.
Oh yeah, sure. God only helps those who help themselves. God's like, don't get into that. Don't
don't be stupid.
Don't do that. All right, so getting back. So the point is like this. The point is, even the highest levels of spiritual light only exist in order to go to the field and wake us up, so to speak. Through this, 369, their inner inherent desire, the soul's inner inherent desire for godliness is revealed, and they depart from the desert, which is the field of the forces opposed to holiness, to the field of holiness to greet the king. Through the tshuva of Jews who were previously estranged from godliness, to the furthermost extent, the inner dimension of the Jewish people is even further revealed, i.e. that their inner desire, even at the time that they sin, is focused on godliness. When do you measure the true power of a soul? It's when the soul can come back from the darkest of places. And they only sin because, 370, because their evil inclination overpowered them. Let's skip the brackets in the interest of time. 371, it's a fascinating bracketed comment. You can look at it and study it on your own, but right now I want to just skip to after the brackets. 371 in the middle of the page. The revelation of the Jews' inner desire for godliness despite their being tainted by sin, which stems from their souls being rooted in God's essence, comes about through the teshuvah of the Jews who were originally in the field of the forces opposed to holiness, i.e. the desert. In other words, when do you see that a soul is truly unbreakable, that the soul's connection is like the engraved letters that cannot be destroyed? When do you see it? You see that when somebody was all the way somewhere else where they shouldn't be, and they still come back, and they correct themselves, they correct their lives, and they make amends, and they do what they need to do to correct their past behavior. When that happens, you see, you know what? Even that soul that we thought was all the way who knows where, even that soul was never truly lost. You can see the power of the soul by the power of its return, by the power of its rebound. Therefore, the elevation that is brought about within the 13 attributes of mercy through their descent and being drawn down to low levels to arouse man comes about primarily, 372, through the arousal of those who were originally drastically distant from him. When do you see the power of God's light? When it reaches the furthest distances and helps awaken and inspire those who were previously disconnected or misaligned or in a place where they shouldn't ideally be, and it reaches that person and it inspires them, and they come back to where they need to be, that's when the light truly fulfills its purpose, and that's when you see the true power of the soul. In the final analysis, chapter 7 reminds us that a soul is never lost. A soul can't be lost. Just like God can't be lost, the soul can't be lost. But unfortunately, sometimes we can forget about our soul. We can act and behave as though we don't have this connection. The message here is we should realize our connection, live by our connection, assert and affirm our connection. And in doing so, we justify, not only justify, it's a harsh term, we celebrate our existence in reality and also the existence of everything else in creation, even the highest lights. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for Kabbalah and Coffee.